Hello, I'm Justine Sullivan. I'm a qualified yoga teacher and yoga student and slight yoga obsessive. This is part two of my yoga podcast, What is Yoga?, which is a general introduction to yoga. In the first podcast, we talked about asana yoga practice, asana being the physical postures that you see in the yoga studio or at the gym or that you see online. And asana is what most people refer to as a yoga practice when they say they practice yoga or they do yoga. So today I want to look at other elements of yoga, and I'm not expecting us to explain the full philosophy from thousands of years of yoga history, but I want to scratch the surface and just look at what else is yoga or what else can be perceived as yoga. So yoga often translates to mean union or to unite. It refers to both the practice and the goal of the practice. The word yoga can be used to refer to a specific set of physical practices. It can be used to describe types of meditative techniques. It may refer to subtle energetic practices or devotional practices. The word yoga can also point to a state of consciousness, bliss, or enlightenment. I'm joined again by two yogis, Ori Das and Savira Gupta. Welcome, guys, again. And if you don't mind, can you please introduce yourself? So, Ori, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Justine. And my name is Ori, very similar to Oreo biscuits. So that's the easiest way to remember it. I started doing yoga when I was about 8 years old, so that's about 41 years ago, with my grandmother. And I went through the entire experience of doing it in India, becoming a teacher at the age of 18, giving it all up, going into law school, divorcing myself completely from any of the oriental practices till I reached London and I realized what was missing in my life, and then got back into yoga. So over this period of time, I have managed to touch on a few areas of yoga. I think there's a lot more to discover.
Savira.
Where do I begin? But I'll make it brief. So first of all, thank you, Justine, for having me and seeing you, Ori, again. So I've been teaching for 15 years and I decided to stop teaching since last year, only because I went through a deep loss. But so this 1 year, what I've been doing is actually studying. And I've been studying the Bhagavad Gita, and I've been studying about Vedanta, the philosophy behind it, more or less in trying to encompass the whole of Sanatana Dharma. So this is where I'm at in my practice.
Sounds like you're perfectly placed for this podcast.
And also
you said a word that I really struggle with. I'll talk about that later, but I will get the pronunciation wrong, and I'd like you to correct me. Thank you for joining me. Really means a lot. So yoga as a collection of tools and techniques for self-realization dates back at least 3,000 years. Its history spans a wide range of techniques that have evolved over the centuries, often with differing points of view, yet building on an overarching theme. In the Katha Upanishad, circa 400 BCE, the term yoga appears, where it is defined as the steady control of the senses, which, along with a cessation of mental activity, leads to the supreme state. This is the first recorded use of the term yoga. It is likely that methods for self-realization had already been practiced for hundreds of years prior to that. So, first question, what are the Upanishads? Who'd like to take that? Savira?
Okay, so first of all, Upanishad means to sit and listen closely. And these are philosophical texts which explain the foundation of Sanatana Dharma, which modern term people use it as Hinduism. So Hinduism was a term coined many years ago But the actual term is actually Sanatan Dharma. So there are about 108 Upanishads, out of which 11 are the most important. And these are ritual observance and an individual's place within the universe. It's the realization of Brahman. It talks about Atma, which is eternal, the higher self or the soul. It's about karma in action, right? And it's about rebirth. That is a huge part of our philosophy. And understanding the cycle of birth and death. So, and most importantly, it's associated with the Vedas. So it's quite a large encyclopedia per se, with 108 volumes, and out of which 11 are the most important. So also we have to understand that each philosophy has their own terminology and their own methodology in the way it is taught. And it's important that we don't mix the two philosophies or the a number of these philosophies together, because context matters when it comes to talking about the philosophy, and depending on which philosophy we're talking about.
Ori, do you want to have a go on this one?
Yeah, I want to try and approach it in a slightly different direction. I think what Sabira said is absolutely perfect. I really don't have anything further to add to it. But I would like to break it down to an understanding level of how do you use the knowledge from the Upanishads practically. So the thinking has been that my Atma, my soul, is part of a larger Brahman creation. Upanishads was a collection of text to help an individual or the community understand the interaction of your soul with the Brahman, which is the larger universe. A very easy way to understand it would be, say you sit down in meditation and you are doing your a seven chakra meditation where you feel all your seven chakras. And as you're feeling those subtle energies, those vortexes sort of spin inside you when you're deep in meditation, when you get right to the top, there's almost like a feeling that you're being pulled into the universe. It's a very subtle feeling, but that feeling is what gives us yogis that sense of bliss. And it's a very simple example of how our soul is part of the larger universe. The Upanishads helped an individual understand the interaction between the self and the universe that you are actually a part of. So yes, those words might feel a little difficult for people that are not familiar with those terms. But in its simplicity, it's finding the divine within yourself and the interaction of your soul with the larger divine. Savira, I don't know if you agree with that. I would love your thoughts on that as well.
No, you've said it quite, you've broken it down to most simplest of understanding. So if you, depending on the text that we read, so for example, if you look, take the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about as human beings, how do we navigate through this world, or how do we navigate in life? We have desires, we have needs. How do we navigate? And to understand that our body is simply a vehicle, right? We use our body to experience. We use the five sensory organs to experience what is on the outside. And how do we form that disengagement with these strong desires that we need that ties us to our cycle of birth and death, and how do we, you know, sort of move away from that cycle. So yes, it is connecting that Atma with Brahman, which is what we call also to join, to merge, to yug or yog. So yeah.
So in many ways that is yoga in its truest form, would you say, or its original form or initial form? So over 3,000 years ago, people were looking for self-realization, looking for understanding. They reached that state. Are you saying?
So see, yoga is a different philosophy. There are six philosophies. Yoga is just one of that philosophy. It is one way of attaining that. Now, and in through yoga, we tend to use a lot of Patanjali, the sutras. That is more of an internal practice, understanding the quality, the mechanism of the mind, right? Whereas the Bhagavad Gita focuses on karma yoga. So how yoga in action. So the methodology, the teaching will be slightly different. Now, the teachings and the methodology slightly different, but the end result is that union. So depending on the philosophy we're using, the context will differ. So for example, if we, the 11 volumes that are well known or used the most, let's say we can take the Mandaka Upanishads. They focus only on meditation and discusses the nature of our Atma, right? And then you'll have another Upanishad which will focus just on the bhakti aspect of it. So again, it's important to use context when we're discussing these things. So likewise, so all 11 will have different, will focus on different areas of the teachings. I hope that makes sense.
Can I just add to that?
Please, yes.
As Savira was speaking, once again, I love examples because I think that it helps understand in the context of today. So say you decide to go out for a curry. Yeah. What is curry? Is there one unified definition of curry? There's so many different forms of curry. For example, the dal, which is cooked in my mother's house, is likely to be slightly different from the dal that is cooked in the neighbor's house. And this is a dal which is being cooked in the state of West Bengal in Calcutta. The dal from South India, entirely different. Oh my God, sometimes you can't even have that dal if you're used to dal from another part of the country. The point that I'm trying to make is that this self-inquiry as to how you connect your soul to the larger universal consciousness, Brahman, was a way of thinking amongst the Hindus, and almost every family practiced it slightly differently. So, for example, as I grew up with my grandparents, the yoga that I witnessed most was dhyana, dharana, pratyahara. So they would spend a lot of time in meditation. The asana work which was done in the morning was done to prepare yourself so that you could sit in Padmasana for hours in front of your gods chanting. That chanting produced a state of bliss. That state of bliss is what helped them connect to a higher divinity. But that's basically the end goal of any of these forms of different practices. Today, yoga is closely identified with Hinduism. Why is that? Well, I guess the prevalent religion where this art or science arose from was Hinduism. So for the Hindus, divinity was Shiva, Brahma, Vishnu, Durga. But for someone of the Muslim faith, it is Allah, a higher form of divinity that you want to connect to. So this process of connecting yourself to a higher self and experience bliss was the aspiration of yoga. That is the history. Let me make a quick segue into science. We have understood that the human brain has endocannabinoids. So it has healing properties and bliss-making properties in itself. That is, you can become high. You can be in a state of bliss. And what is the technology behind it? The technology is to deeply relax your nervous system. Try and focus on your pineal gland such that the pineal gland may release quantities of DMT, dimethyl tryptophan, N,N-dimethyl tryptophan. Now, in South America and other places, they use plant extracts like our ayahuasca to try and make that happen. So I believe every religion, every part of the world has tried to implement this system in different ways. It's just that it was codified really well in India. And this massive confusion that exists about eight limbs of yoga, six branches of yoga, so on and so forth, to me, feels nothing more than different recipes of the same curry made in different households. That's it.
I think that's really nicely explained. And thank you to both of you, because it's a lot clearer in my head as well. I think it is confusing for a lot of people who step into a yoga studio to go and practice yoga, what's on the menu. You know, they don't quite know. They've just gone to have a curry. They've just walked in to do yoga. Or they may not have even gone to a restaurant to have curry. They've just gone to a restaurant that had curry on the menu. And, you know, they might have joined a gymnasium and there's a yoga class there. And they've dipped their toe into that. They've gone to that class and something's clicked and they've gone, you know what, I like this. I like how I feel right now. I felt good. And I think that's what happened to me. Because I didn't grow up in India. I didn't grow up in a very religious background in the UK either. My parents aren't religious. So for me, the yoga thing has always been very physical in the form of the physical practice, the asanas. And the stuff, the bliss that you've talked about, Ori, has come from physically practicing the yoga. But then a lot of people I know talk about yoga sutras and this and that. And I'm thinking, well, I need to know about this. What are these things? What are these things people are talking about? And then, of course, I did my yoga teacher training and suddenly you're given a shopping list of books to buy. One, the yoga Pradipika. I'm like, OK, must have that. I'm going to say this wrong, the Bhagavad Gita. But when I first heard that word, I just think of Inner Garda Davida. Do you know that song by Iron Butterfly? So I can't say the Bhagavad Davida because I just go Inner Garda Davida, which actually was written by somebody who was so off their face, they'd already reached eternal bliss, that they were trying to write the In the Garden of Eden. And they ended up writing Inner Garda Davida. So then I'm thinking, well, I need to read all these things. I need to know exactly what all these things are. And then someone says, oh, and also you need to read the Yoga Sutras by Patanjali. And I'm like, well, what is all this stuff? And then I'm thinking, I've got a bit of FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. I'm thinking, what have I missed out on so many years of things? Should I have read all these things? Should I know all these things inside out? Where do I start? And then even trying to do this podcast, I was trying to write questions and then I was going down 1,000 rabbit holes every day, just going, well, where do you need to start?
I have two things to say. One, you never know what a curry can do. It can set your taste buds on flame, or it can have you leave thinking, oh, that was a wonderful meal. Need to come back to it again. But jokes aside, you are entirely right that there are a lot of Sanskrit words. And some of the words actually have the effect of obfuscating rather than clarifying, because there's just a lot. Can I say that, Justine, I, who grew up in India, studying Sanskrit and several other Indian languages, I have similar feelings to what you have. What are all these terms? And as I was growing up, what I also found in India, that this knowledge gap would often be exploited by charlatans, godmen, gurus, who would come to bless your house through vastu, how should the house be constructed, through astrological charts, who you should marry, what you should do. Why? Because these were people who have ancient Vedic knowledge. And frankly, what it ended up becoming is a huge exercise of social exploitation, where one caste, the Brahmins, would say, we are the blessed ones, we are the priests, we have the knowledge. When we were born, it was fed into us. Now, come and genuflect to me. So I have seen this knowledge and its absence being misused on a massive scale in a country with 1.4 billion people. I am not very convinced by many of these terms if they don't mean anything to the practitioner. So how does one start getting into these terms? And it's exactly how it happens. There are, if you think the end goal is bliss, and you get started with an onion, when you're doing your hatha yoga, which is, you know, your physical yoga, you're peeling just the top layer of the onion. So you say you've peeled it. And as you were doing your asana, you realized that when you employed ujjayi breath into the asana, hang on, suddenly the sense of bliss is distinctly different from the class where I did not apply ujjayi pranayama. That makes you realize, hang on, there is another layer below the layer that had just peeled. And the first layer was one of physicality. I've just discovered another layer. And that layer is one of a certain state of bliss that I'm experiencing by harnessing breath. Oh, by the way, that's called pranayama. Good. From there, you fixate your view on a particular spot while doing yoga. So you've got the physicality of yoga, you've built in your pranayama, and now you're focusing your gaze on a certain spot, drishti. And then you realize, hang on, this feels, a combination of these three feels a little bit better than just using two, which was physicality and pranayama. When I include drishti in it, I somehow experience bliss a little bit more. So you peel on another layer and you go a little bit deeper. And that at the end of it all, when you sit down in dharana and you are feeling completely blissed out, you realize that, hang on, there may be another layer even below that. So I feel for a yoga practitioner, yoga is like an onion. It just depends on you, how you peel it, and whether you have an appetite to peel it any further. Some people who experience that bliss and have, sometimes I say this lightly, have the disposition of a junkie. Let me experience bliss more. Let me get high even more. They start going deeper and deeper into these layers of un. And for many others, just the physicality of it is enough. So I would say that rather than focus on all these big, big words, which ends up giving the practitioner a sense that, you know, I'm just a half-baked practitioner because I can't utter all these crazy words in a foreign language. I don't believe you should have that view. I believe bliss can be experienced just by chanting Allah's name or Krishna's name or thinking about Mother Mary. So this is capable of replication in any culture, any language. I wouldn't get too fixated with some of these Sanskrit terms. That's just my personal view. With that, I'll hand it over to Sabira.
Okay, I'm going to be slightly different here. So first of all, the word bliss, when we talk about bliss, again, we need to put it into context. So that's the Anandamaya Kosha, right? Where now we're talking about the five koshas. So we're talking how each layer has a certain function. So that state of blissness or blissfulness that we are trying to achieve, I think it's very different when we actually start to talk. Are we talking, what are we talking about when we use the word bliss? So for me, my understanding is that you can still live an everyday life, but find those moments of that steadiness is what we are really looking, that sort of disengagement or that addictiveness to the pleasures and the desires or the aversions that we feel for certain things. So that to me is the practice of yoga. I can find bliss now in this 5-minute conversation, but at the same time, I can probably enjoy the conversation and enjoy what I'm getting out of this conversation without getting too attached to it. So I need to find that balance. Now, the idea of studying all of these, I think there is a time and a place, and the person has to be ready and open to study. So when someone says you need to read all these books, there's no point reading all these books till you have yourself established in some kind of understanding about who you are, what is Atma, what is it that you're searching for. Each philosophy will give you a different way of practicing. Now, most people tend to follow, or from what I do, for me, it's the Bhagavad Gita. I'm a human being. I like good things.
Just to interrupt you very quickly, could you explain what that is, what the Bhagavad Gita is?
Right. So the Bhagavad Gita is a conversation between Lord Krishna and Arjuna on the battlefield. So it is this conversation that's been taken out of the Mahabharata, right? The Mahabharata is the bigger picture between the war between the Pandavas and the Kauravas, the two sides of the cousin. And this conversation on the Bhagavad Gita is when Arjun is reluctant to pick up his arms to go into war. So it's this conversation between Krishna and Arjun that how do I do it? How do I go into war and know that it's the right thing? So it's learning about himself. But the main focus is this and always dharma in mind, right? So again, dharma is another word. Dharma would be certain personal duties, certain society duties that we have, duties that are dependent on our skill sets, duties that depend on our role. But the bigger picture is universal ethics. So which we call the cosmic law or the universal law. So Bhagavad Gita is the conversation between Krishna and Arjun. And many people use the Bhagavad Gita because we are living in today's world. We have desires, we have aversions, we have needs. How do we support this without getting too attached to it? And so that's what the Bhagavad Gita gives us, answers those questions. Whereas the eight limbs or Patanjali is more of an individual internal practice, which takes you from the gross level to the more subtle level. So that's the difference between the two texts.
Hey, can I just add two things here to which Savira has said, which will sort of, I think, help understand. In this case of Bhagavad Gita, Arjun, his job was to go and kill his own brothers. So he faced a moral conundrum. And in solving his moral conundrum, his charioteer, Krishna, takes the form of God and explains and gives him that discourse. So that's. But there's one major difference between how Orient looks at life and how Occident looks at life. And this is a fundamental difference between the two cultures. In the West, we are driven by rights, i.e. this is my right. I'm driving, you've come in front of me, get out, I have right of way. This is my house, you came and knocked on my door at a time I consider to be an unsociable hour. You have infringed upon my rights. Now, in the East, and this I have found probably exists all the way from Japan, all the way probably to the Middle East, this way of thinking, which is it's a duty-based model. That is, every human being that lives in a society has duty towards their fellow creatures, plants, animals, existence, and their society. Now, in implementing the latter, the duty-based system, the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, they laid down a moral code which helped people implement the duty-based model of living. So even now, Justine, if you go to India and say you go to a village and say you go to the house of a villager who has to leave home early in the morning to go to work, he would probably tell his wife, I'm going to do my duty. I'm going for duty. I'm going for duty rather than I'm going to work. So it just tells you the two very different ways of thinking, which despite technology and airlines and people crisscrossing the globe, that hasn't quite changed. That still continues to be the case.
If I could add to Ori's, it's a very simple, when you look at an Indian way of life or East, or you know, as we say from that side of the world, it's very much to do with society, community, to helping one another. So let's say you're at home and you're having dinner, someone comes knocking on their door. You will not say, oh, I'm having my dinner, I'll talk to you later. The first thing we'll do is, no, you come in, we'll set a table, you sit with us, you eat with us. Why? Because it's our duty. No questions asked. You don't think twice. So we have these, so each, even as we move through different stages of our life, we have certain duties, right? So we have the ashrama dharma, which talks about the four stages of our life, from going from someone who is learning to someone who becomes a householder, to someone who then changes or moves into grandparents, and then decide that the last one, very few are doing it nowadays in India. We tend to focus on the first three. Then we're also taught that as individuals, when we are living in this country, what is our aim? Why are we here? Right? So then we're given four aims of life. Right? These are the four goals that we need to achieve, to work towards, to. So we have, again, our duty to make sure that we can fulfill those needs by we work, we earn money, we support the family, we support the children, right? Then we have desires. We want to fulfill those desires, but we don't want to be too attached to them that we become addicted. So these codes of conduct or these ethical values are eternal for us, because the soul takes birth and follows them again. So they're eternal. They're never ending. And so that's where Sanatana comes in. Sanatana means eternal, and dharma means duty. And Hinduism is more or less lives. We tend to follow a lot with nature, in alignment with nature. And you'll notice most indigenous culture have to do with nature.
So essentially, the yoga philosophy really is a code of conduct for just living a certain way.
That's it.
But I agree with you, Ori, with something you said earlier, where you said there's a sort of there's a gap of people who know and the people who are trying to know. And in all my 23 years of practicing physical yoga, as in going to a yoga studio and going on a mat, not once did anyone say, we're going to spend 15, 20 minutes talking about yoga philosophy. So all of that stuff about yoga philosophy comes from your desire to want to read more, or you hear a word and you think, oh, what do they mean, eight limbs of yoga? No one tells you, no one takes you by the hand and says, let me show you what this is. You know, if you walk into a yoga studio, you see a load of books. Some of it's mindfulness, some of it's self-help books, some of it's Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, some of it's the Bhagavad Gita, and you're like, what do I buy? And like I said, it's no one actually guiding you. And that's very much how I feel. And then, like I said, when you go and do a teacher training course, you're given this shopping list of books to get and to read and to study, and you study them really quickly on your yoga course. And again, even then, there's words and phrases and stuff that you're just sitting there thinking, I don't know what you mean. And then the your yoga teacher might strike up a conversation with another student in the class about another book that they've read, and you're thinking, it's too, you know, feeling slightly overwhelmed by what I should know, and is it bad that I don't know all these things? But the one book that has actually resonated, I mean, obviously I enjoyed you know, the divine conversation between, you know, Arjuna and Krishna, you know, I enjoyed that. But the Yoga Sutras, for me, when I read them, completely make sense. A lot of it makes sense to me. I mean, and then you hear Ashtanga, eight limbs of yoga. So is that the book that all yogis should be reading? Or
so if I may just add one bit before we move to that, to your question, is that I think these books are not meant to, that's my personal opinion, they're not meant to be read alone by yourself. So whether it's the Bhagavad Gita or the sutras, it's always good to have a teacher who is established in that to guide you. Because again comes the understanding. Are we looking at these books, again, from the yogic perspective? Or are we looking in it from a personal experience perspective? Or are we looking at it with a modern lens perspective? So it's very important on, and how we look at it will change our understanding of the book. So it's important. So I'll let Ori take the question now about sutras.
Basically, Justine is asking, which is the best recipe book for a curry? It depends on the curry that you like. For example, when I went through the Yoga Sutras the first time, it felt like gibberish to me. I'll be honest with you. And I did not have the luxury of saying that out aloud, lest I look like a fool in front of others, because this is something which I should have known. I have a feeling a lot of yogis suffer from the same position. But Justin, you are actually helping solve for this issue. I'll answer this question slightly differently. So after doing yoga for a while, when I buggered off to law school, more than law, I found judo supremely interesting. So I spent a good 7 years studying judo, Japanese terms, Japanese philosophy. And Justin, the problem that you're having right now with Sanskrit is the problem that I had with ancient Japanese, because, you know, that's how the different throws in the philosophy of judo is described. After pondering on that question a lot, which is the best judo book to read, what I realized was the best judokas weren't the ones that were reading, but the ones that were practicing. I do not attach a huge amount of importance to some of these historical texts, because much of it is first written in an ancient foreign language. And what we are living with are numerous interpretations of other people to some very vague texts. So I don't treat that as my North Star. My North Star is my sense of bliss that I experience when I do yoga. Completely not answering the question, but just wanted to explain my thoughts.
So, Saveri, before you interrupt, can I just sort of say, Ori, you've nailed it for me. Thank you.
So only thing I was going to say was, there's no rush to pick up these books.
No, I know.
Right? First, live the practice. So live what you know now or what you've learned now. Right? Put that into action. There will come a point in your life where at one fine day, you will pick up a book that will resonate with you. And that's it. There's no rush. You already, your practice has a lot to give you to churn, to digest, right? It's taken me so many years. And if I had to choose between the two, I have no affiliation or I have no connection with the sutras. I can't. To me, it just doesn't work. So for me, the Bhagavad Gita works. But it's taken me a traumatic experience to go into the Bhagavad Gita. So you may pick it up 10 years from now or maybe 2 years from now. So if your school or teachers are saying you have to do it now, I wouldn't recommend that right now.
Yeah, I mean, have you heard of the phrase imposter syndrome?
Yeah.
I'm a lawyer. I have a professional qualification in that.
Yeah.
Imposter syndrome.
I've 23 years in television and about 6 to 8 in the music industry before that. And I've certainly found myself in situations in both the music industry and television where I've been in a room, in an environment, very close proximity, the main contact for very, 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 very famous people. The most famous people on the planet. And they've written me thank you notes. Thank you for a wonderful day. But even then, I'm like, I'm going to get found. Someone's going to find me out at some point that I'm a fake. I am obsessed with yoga. I can't help it. I dream about it. I read about it. I'm constantly looking at it. I'm constantly wanting to understand my physical yoga practice a lot more. David Swenson, Ashtanga yogi, he said the strongest tree grows the slowest. And I'm a very slow growing tree. Vitabi Joy would have called me a bad lady of yoga, practicing Ashtanga for 23 years and still can't do X, Y, and Z. It doesn't matter. I will. I'll do it at 80, you know. And I suppose in a way, what you both have said to me is, if it's going to come, it will come in terms of yoga philosophy. And it doesn't matter if it's not there. And also, it's probably not important to have depth of knowledge from all these books that are thousands of years old in order to teach a yoga practice.
Well, put it this way. You have those who focus on asana. You have those who focus on the philosophy aspect, and those who focus on the mantra aspect, the bhakti aspect. So you choose as one part of the entire practice that you resonate with, and you teach from what you know. And over time, that will grow. So it's patience, it's taking it slow. It's really all about digesting what you've learned, putting it into action, and then see what the result is. And for all you know, you may find something totally different that you resonate with, or you may find that your teaching career or what you're teaching will move in a different direction.
No, exactly, exactly. It's funny because my rocket yoga teacher, a very lovely lady called Amber Jean, and she sent me a message earlier, practice what you teach and teach what you practice. And you couldn't put it more simpler than that, really. That you can't go and teach something that you're finding hard to get your head around. Yeah. Because it's not going to be genuine. It's not going to be authentic. Correct. And I do think that, you know, there is an elite world of yoga where I don't know whether it's intentional or not, but one can feel slightly intimidated if you can't recite the Yoga Sutras verbatim.
When we are not open, when we're not ready, then it will show in our way of teaching or practice. And at the same time, teaching yoga or becoming a yoga teacher is not for everybody. And reaching that samadhi or that is not for everybody. Some people only want to do it so that they feel good in the body. And that's fine. We are all different individuals going through our stages of life differently, and our needs and desires are going to be different. So if you have someone who comes to your yoga class because he or she or they want to feel good in the body, let them. And I think there's a lot of pressure in the last 2 years of you have to study this, you have to do this, otherwise you are not
authentic.
Yes, which to me, no. You know, just by saying, okay, you need to study A, B, C, D, E, what do you do with the study? You've got to experience it, and that takes time. That could take time. Yeah. And we're not given that time because we're told we need to take these classes, take these workshops, and then now we've got to go teach them.
Okay. Yeah, for me, I have I have various books that I just dip into. The Yoga Sutras being one of those. So they're the Yoga Sutras by Patanjali. And Patanjali we don't even know, was it one person? Was it several people? Was it male? Was it female? We don't know. No one really knows. But it's a collection of sutras or...
There are about 109 threads.
Yeah.
Each year, and the book is broken into four parts, right?
Yeah.
So, and then the four parts have, it's systematic, right? So you have the first part of the book is about that enlightenment. The second part is the purpose or the practice. The third part are what are the obstacles. And then the fourth part is the Kevalya, which is the end result. So it's broken up that way. And it's a systematic step-by-step guide as to how you can reach Kevalya. So and that's where the yamas and the niyamas come in and the eight limbs come in. So in short, that is what the Yoga Sutras are about. It's not for everybody. I know when I read it or with the teacher, it didn't really resonate with me as the Bhagavad Gita does. So, and there's nothing wrong being a yoga teacher. It's good to get an idea, to have a background about it. But what is it that you resonate with? And you can teach your class with that philosophy. But most important, we need to stick to one set of philosophy and keep that methodology and teaching continuous. Because when we bring a philosophy from one text and mix it with another text, it becomes confusing for the students.
And I think as somebody, you know, especially someone who is brought up in the West, if you are then given all these texts, it's very hard to decipher, because there are words that are in a different language. It's very hard to decipher, well, is this the same as that one? Or is this what, which one should I be reading? So you've got eight limbs of yoga, which is in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. Now that is relevant to Ashtanga yoga, because Asht is eight and Anga is limb. So eight limbs of yoga. So obviously Ashtanga yoga is a particular practice. Again, there'll be another podcast on what Ashtanga yoga is, and I might go more into it then. But I can honestly say in the 23 years that I've been practicing Ashtanga, that at not one point did we ever talk about the yamas and the niyamas. I mean, it's probably too much to go into now, but do you think, I mean, obviously number one is the yamas.
So you have the yamas and the niyamas. Yamas, which are the ethical values, right, or conducts. And then niyamas are your internal, personal. So you have yama, niyama, asana, pranayama. Then you have dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. I don't think I'm missing anything else.
Pratyahara.
Pratyahara.
Yeah. So samadhi is obviously merging with the divine. Yeah. So basically, but this is it's a code of conduct, but not everyone. Sorry. Yeah. The first two, the codes of conduct, but not everybody can follow those these days. Yeah.
It's not easy, as you will find many people say, oh, ahimsa, you know, what you're doing. Ahimsa is quite deep, you know, and it requires a thorough establishment in practicing these. So Patanjali says that because these are for individuals, it's important for a person to establish, before they move into asana, to establish in the yamas and niyamas, because the movement and how we move and what we establish ourselves in will determine the flow of energy within the system, within the individual system.
Yeah.
So establish yourself in these ethics, then move on to the asana, the pranayama, then your pratyahara, dharana, dhyana.
Mm. On paper, they make a lot of sense. And also physically, with a strong yoga practice, like a strong Ashtanga practice, there are things in there that I'm not going to go too deeply into right now. There are things in there that you wouldn't do before your practice, because it will affect your practice, including eating a large meal that's mainly based, lots of meat based, you know. That's why, you know, they're asking you to have a lighter, more vegan based diet. You know, if you're kind of like, you know, if you're eating great big steaks and then 3 hours later you're expected to go and practice Ashtanga yoga, you know, trust me, you won't get the same result as if you had a diet which was slightly lighter based, like more vegan.
I think vegan is something that is only new.
Yeah, it doesn't work for everybody.
Vegan is only new. And it has always said to eat a lighter diet. The emphasis, we have to think, in those days, vegetables were more available, fresher, without any additive.
Also without any risk of contamination.
Exactly. So we have to take into consideration when this book was written. It was written to a certain time. Now it's slightly different. So even our eating habits are slightly different, but there's still the same gist still applies. Mm. So if you have a heavy meal the night before you practice, you will feel it in your body the next day. Yep. So that's why it's recommended eat a lighter meal beforehand.
So I did a workshop the other week, and it was a movement workshop for the wrists and shoulders and arms. And I spoke to the guy that was running the workshop before I signed up to ask him, are we working on arm balances as in yoga? Mm-hmm. And he said, no, we're talking more about the nervous system. It was more Pilates based. And I got a lot out of it, actually. I got a lot out of it for me. But there was a few people in the room that had this idea that they wanted to learn how to get into Barkasana, crow posture. And at the end, you know, the teacher sort of demonstrated his kind of version of what Barkasana would be. And I said, well, let me show you the yogi version, because I know this particular student is interested in doing it like this. And I was explaining the position stuff, but it was something he said, which was he said something along the lines of, this is the safest way to get into this posture physically because of the structure of your arms, but I'm sure when you did it in yoga, you're getting divine enlightenment. and I just looked at him. I thought, that's quite funny, but you mean that, don't you? There is something in there where, whether he means it or not, that when we practice yoga, that we're doing each posture to get divine enlightenment, you know, or reaching that, you know, or to merge with the divine. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't, you know, and a lot of us aren't looking to merge with the divine by doing Barkasana properly. We're just doing it. And then with that in mind, do we need to persuade more people to do Pilates and not yoga if it's just to move better?
So first of all, personally, I think there was a little bit of sarcasm from his side, right? Because we talk about yoga being divine enlightenment. And I think there we go, that understanding of divine enlightenment is not within context, and it has not been understood what the whole practice is about. So his understanding of divine enlightenment in yoga, it does not pertain to asana, because there's so much focus on asana as being the it part of yoga. No, I think many people take up yoga. It's good to take up yoga because it focuses on your whole physical, mental, and emotional health. Pilates is also great. Some people will move towards Pilates. Some people will move towards yoga, just like some people take up badminton and some people take up dancing. So no, I don't think there's no need to push either or. Let the individual decide where they want to go. And secondly, not everybody is working towards enlightenment.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, I did take his comment with a pinch of salt. I didn't take it, but it made me think. I thought, well, we need a podcast about Pilates and yoga. Savira, as always, it's been really lovely to talk to you.
No, nice talking to you too. Yeah.
And thank you. And thank you to Ori for joining us. And sadly, Ori got pulled away for a meeting. So he didn't say goodbye in person, but he did say thank you on a chat. So Savira, thank you so much.
Thank you. Look forward to the next one. You take care.
Thank you for listening. And hopefully you've enjoyed this podcast, and there'll be more to follow. The next lot of podcasts will be around the physical practice. We're going to break down the styles of yoga and talk a little bit about what they are when you see a particular style of yoga advertised. What does it mean? What are you going to let yourself in for? Thank you for listening. Take care.